We know that many congregations are putting together their budgets for the next fiscal year. Please consider adding the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. to your congregation's mission or advertising budget for 2009. Simply go to the sponsors page of our website, issuesetc.org, and find out more about the Issues Etc. 300. We're looking for 300 congregations to donate $1,000 to Issues Etc. You'll even find a one-page flyer that you can hand out. Thanks for your support. In the last 10 minutes of this hour, we're going to go, I'd say, about halfway back in Christian history, at least halfway back to the apostles, to a very important time. We're going to be talking, as the church remembers on this day, Anselm of Canterbury, an 11th, 12th century monk, archbishop, theologian. Dr. Matt Phillips joins us. You can join us as well. Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. Coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, the 21st of April, 1-877-623-6943, or our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org. Dr. Matt Phillips is Assistant Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Matt, welcome back.
It's very good to be back with you.
Where would we see the influence of a man like Anselm of Canterbury most clearly today in the church?
I think theologically speaking, the most important place where you would see his influence is in the theology of the atonement or theology of redemption. His work called Why God Became Man, in which he tried to explain using reason without appealing to authority, instead of just quoting biblical scriptures, he wanted to use reason to explain why it was necessary that God to become man to redeem humanity. And basically, he said that since the penalty was so great, and that the penalty of sin was so great that only an infinite God-man could redeem humanity. To actually take the place of the rest of humanity. And I'd say that it's very biblically based still, although he didn't just use, quote, scriptures. I mean, this idea certainly existed in the New Testament and all the way through Christianity, but he emphasized that particular idea, that it was a payment of the debt that man owed, that human beings owed to God. And the previous idea, what that had been emphasized more in the early Middle Ages, was the idea of the devil's rights theory, in that the devil had gained rights over humanity, and that Jesus was kind of paying off the devil, which that idea kind of exists. You could appeal to scriptures to kind of get that idea too, but he emphasized the other idea of paying the debt back to God.
So his, we'll call it a theory of the atonement, seems right. to have really caught on, especially in the Western church.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it sounds as though that's, in many ways, although there are other ways of conceiving of the act of the atonement, the propitiation, this substitutionary model,
right.
really, I can't think that there'd be a Reformation without that thing.
I was thinking the same idea. I mean, and, you know, people that have written about this more extensively or thought about it more than I have, I mean, as a medieval historian, you have to learn about all Anselm. He's very important in many other ways, too. But yeah, in theology, I would say his influence, just for that kind of idea of this the use of the ideas of debt, and then satisfaction. Only the God-man could, quote, satisfy the debt that humanity owed back to God.
Give us a brief biography of the man Anselm.
All right. He was actually from what today would be northern Italy. He was born around 1033. He was probably minor nobility. Around 1060, or around that time, he wandered north. He had a countryman, an older fellow named Lanfranc, that was an abbot in Normandy, which is in France. And he became a monk at that monastery known as Bec. He sometimes called Anselm of Bec. He was actually there longer than Canterbury. And he became a prior there and then later abbot of Bec, which was the highest position in the monastery, the father of the monastery. And then in 1093, he was essentially appointed Archbishop of Canterbury by the son of William the Conqueror, William II, who was came from Normandy originally, that family, and conquered England. And then there was some negotiation with the Pope, and then the Pope also approved it as him as Archbishop of Canterbury, where he remained in that office until his death in 1109. And he kind of spans a lot of issues, theology, philosophy, and he was involved in he was kicked out of England, exiled for a while by both William the King and then his successor Henry the First. So there were some issues there too that he was involved in too. So he was a ecclesiastical figure. He was a theologian and a philosopher and a monk, and so he kind of spans a lot of things in that sense.
There is a bit of negative, well, it's not a bit, it's actually a tremendous amount of negative influence that can be laid, at least in part, at Anselm's doorstep, and I think we've even discussed it with you in the past on issues, etc. Without Anselm, there probably would not have been this very strong move of scholasticism in the Western Church. What is it, and why would we do well to be wary of the scholastic theologians?
Well, I would say he probably gets a little bit of a bad rap for that. His was much more of the monastic tradition of almost like, I don't want to say mental games, but monastic tradition of contemplation that went back to Augustine. And much of the early scholasticism that he might have been involved in always started with faith. Actually, his catchphrase was, "I believe that I may understand." That really goes back to Augustine, the 4th and 5th century theologian. And so whenever he was using, for lack of a better term, logic or reason or dialectic to explain faith, it was always from the basis of, yes, we accept these things because God has told us this, but can we use reason to explain them? And it certainly wasn't as definitive as, say, a Thomas Aquinas is later. And he was much more gravitated towards the thought of Augustine and what we would call Platonism instead of Aristotle. He really didn't have access to the text of Aristotle the way later scholastics would.
So he's a pre-scholastic. I mean, that's
the best way to say. What I would say, or early scholastic. Yeah, because he wasn't really in the schools either. He was in the monastery, which had a school, but it wasn't what developed into the major schools and then universities in the 12th and 13th century.
Is there any connection beyond just the Canterbury connection with the general direction that much later in the English Reformation, the Church of England takes?
So. No, not really. I wouldn't say so.
All right, then let's talk finally about his devotional work. I understand he has tremendous influence.
Oh, absolutely.
There.
What's really interesting, you know, he wrote this stuff on the Incarnation, so he was obviously spent a lot of time thinking theologically about what did it mean for Christ to become a human being. And his devotional work kind of takes that another way. He wrote a number of prayers, both to Christ and, of course, as a medieval theologian, to saints. But he wrote many of these prayers to lay women particularly. And these prayers will be copied in numerous manuscripts, some of them authentic, and then later other people copy his prayers and try to pass them off, but that was common in the Middle Ages. And they float through monastic houses, but also to lay people. These prayers are very affective. I don't just mean emotional, that was part of it, but they were affective. They focused on the sufferings of Christ, how Christ, he speaks in first person talking about his, why wasn't I there to watch Christ die, like his mother who was obviously upset at his death. Why wasn't my soul pierced like Christ's side was pierced? So it's almost like he, this kind of idea of incorporating yourself into the events of the Passion to more deeply appreciate both, one, your own sinfulness, but two, the redemption that Christ provided through those things.
Dr. Matt Phillips is Assistant Professor of History at Concordia University, Nebraska. Thank you so much for your time.
I had a good time. Thank you.
When we come back from this break, we're going to be studying for the entire second hour of the program an Easter hymn. This is really a Easter hymn par excellence, if you ask me. It's called Joy to the Heart. It simply must be heard to be understood for all of its excellence, and we'll be studying it with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois, so stay tuned for the second hour. Joy to the Heart, this Easter hymn study, is coming up right after this. During tomorrow's first hour, we're going to talk with Dr. John Kleinig about true biblical spirituality, not the kind of spirituality that you generate from within, but the kind that comes to you from outside, from God himself. Hidden holiness, true spirituality. Tomorrow, first hour on Issues, Etc. So if you believe that Christ hung there on the cross, as your substitute. You have that idea, not primarily, but certainly with some help from Anselm, who, of course, was borrowing from none other than Holy Scripture. We heard recently in the Bible readings in church that Christ has become the propitiation for our sins. What does that mean? It means, it's a fancy word that means substitute. He has become the payment and the substitute for you and for me in his death, in his suffering, in his life, in his resurrection. And this isn't a notion that the church dreamt up recently or that Martin Luther suddenly came to at the time of the Reformation as a good idea, a bright idea. No, it's echoed throughout the works and the words of men like Anselm all the way back to St. Paul and to Christ himself, who is our propitiation, who is the payment for our sin and our substitute in life, in death, and in resurrection. And therein lies our comfort. And to stand on the shoulders of giants like Anselm and others and confess along with them the same voice with which St. Paul spoke, that Christ now stands in our place. He enters human flesh so that he might take your place, my place, all of mankind's place in his life, his suffering, his death, and his resurrection. And that is precisely what he has done for us and for the whole world. When we come back, we are going to study an Easter hymn, Joy to the Heart. Pastor Will Wheaton will be our guest. Stay tuned.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.